Welcome back to We're All Mad Here. I'm your host, Rachel. If ever one needed an example of privileged naivete, they would need not look further than the literary couple Zelda and F. Scott Fitzgerald. Coming from two different worlds, the two joined forces to wreak havoc on New York City, live well beyond their means, and have the most tempestuous of marriages. Today, we're talking about Zelda, because F. Scott has gotten enough attention. Zelda Sayer was born on July 24, 1900, in Montgomery, Alabama. She was the youngest of six and is thought to have been named after a novel heroine, either after Zelda, a tale of the Massachusetts colony, or Zelda's fortune. Her family was well off. Anthony Sayer was a state legislator, and both Anthony and wife Minnie's families had been slaveholders for generations. One of Zelda's biographers, Nancy Milford, wrote, "If there was a Confederate establishment in the Deep South, Zelda came from the heart of it." And unfortunately, Zelda would remain loyal to the Confederacy for her entire life. She saw nothing wrong with her family's position in the South. After all, it's what brought her the lifestyle she had come to enjoy, and how could that be wrong? Zelda's maternal grandfather was a Confederate senator, and a paternal great-uncle was a Confederate general, and at one point, the second Grand Dragon of the KKK of Alabama. Yikes. Not only that, but Zelda's extended family owned the first White House of the Confederacy, and Zelda herself said that she got strength from her Confederate past. By the time Zelda was born, the Sayers were no longer slaveholders, instead paying a mostly black staff to work in the household. But 1900 was not that far removed from the family's slaveholding days, and the Sayers acted accordingly. Anthony Sayer, in his capacity as state legislator, wrote the Sayer Act of 1893, which paved the way for Jim Crow to start in Alabama and, quote, disenfranchise black Alabamians for 70 years. But Zelda had nothing to worry about herself, at least for now. While her father was strict, Zelda's mother Minnie spoiled her daughter. Zelda didn't have to trouble herself with chores and instead spent her time playing outside and taking ballet lessons. Ballet would be a lifelong love for Zelda, but she didn't have the discipline to make it a career. She continued her training into high school, but was quoted in a newspaper interview about an upcoming dance performance that she only cared about, quote, boys and swimming. And indeed, Zelda may have spent a lot of time in ballet class, but the rest of her time was spent smoking, drinking, and trying to get the attention of boys. One of her favorite things to do was go swimming while wearing a tight, flesh-colored swimsuit to shock people into thinking she was swimming naked. For Zelda, getting attention was the goal. How she got it didn't matter. For any other young lady, these antics would have ruined their reputation, but Zelda's father's place in society prevented, as Milford wrote, her social ruin. And so Zelda spent her high school years partying and in general being a menace. She was voted most attractive in her class, and her senior quote in the yearbook was, "Why should all life be work when we can all borrow? Let's think only of today and not worry about tomorrow." This would be a philosophy she clung onto throughout her life, even when it didn't serve her. Just before her 18th birthday in 1918, freshly graduated from school, Zelda met 23-year-old F. Scott Fitzgerald. But it wasn't love at first sight, at least not for Scott. He'd recently dropped out of Princeton and chose the military life in response to the deep depression he'd entered when the girl he'd been courting, the socialite Ginevra King, rejected him for being poor. Fortunately, or maybe unfortunately, for both Scott and Zelda, the Army sent Scott to Camp Sheridan, just outside of Montgomery, Alabama. And while Scott was taken by the beautiful Zelda and began to court her, he was still writing letters to Ginevra on the side, begging her to reconsider her rejection. He also pursued other young women on the Montgomery social scene. But Zelda was barely 18 and reveled in Scott's attention. Scott's attention to Zelda, however, was largely dependent on Ginevra's choices. In September of 1918, when Scott had been courting Zelda and others for 3 months, he learned that Ginevra was engaged to a polo player. Ginevra got married on September 4th, and Scott told Zelda he loved her on September 7th. He wrote to a girl named Isabella, "I love her, and that's the beginning and end of everything. You're still a Catholic, but Zelda's the only god I have left now." Talk about pressure for an 18-year-old. But while Zelda loved the attention from Scott, she didn't return his feelings of worship. When the two got time together, they'd often stroll through the nearby Confederate cemetery. How romantic. And Zelda was annoyed by how irreverent Scott was. Zelda told Scott he'd never understand how much she admired the fallen Confederates. She also questioned what he told her. When Scott confided that he wanted to be a novelist and had even written most of a novel, Zelda didn't believe him, even when he sent her a chapter of his work in progress, The Romantic Egoist. Even so, Scott rewrote the character of Rosalind Connage to more closely mirror Zelda. He wrote to her, "The heroine does resemble you in more ways than four." But biographer Milford believes that what really attracted Zelda to Scott was something that, quote, no one before him had perceived, a romantic sense of self-importance, which was kindred to Scott's own. After 4 months of courting, the army called up Scott for service. Scott feared he'd be heading to France to fight on the front lines, but instead he ended up in the exotic land of Long Island, New York. While he was there, the Allied powers signed armistice with Imperial Germany, and Scott was sent back to Montgomery and Zelda. Not having seen each other for about 3 months, the two immediately jumped each other's bones in an act labeled sexual recklessness by Scott. Scott remained in Montgomery until he was discharged from the army in February of 1919, and by that point the couple considered themselves informally engaged. There was no ring, however, and Zelda told Scott that she would not marry him until he was financially successful and could give her the lifestyle she'd become accustomed to. But in order to do that, Scott had to get out of Alabama. He moved to New York City, and Zelda was astonished that he'd left her behind. In an act fitting her immature age, Zelda wrote Scott telling him that, surprise, she was pregnant. In response, Scott nailed her abortion pills, to which Zelda responded, "I'd rather have a whole family than sacrifice my self-respect. I'd feel like a damn whore if I even took one." As you may have guessed, she didn't need abortion pills anyway. The pregnancy story had just been a bid for his attention. It seems like the Zelda and Scott timeline manages to cram 10 times the amount of events as a normal person's. Just a month after the whole abortion pill debacle, Scott sent Zelda his mother's ring, which both interpreted as them being officially engaged, until a few months later when Zelda decided that Scott's career should have taken off by now and broke off the engagement. Scott was so despondent after this that he reportedly carried a revolver with him every day, just in case he wanted to act on his suicidal thoughts. In July of 1919, single again, Scott moved back to his parents' house in his hometown of St. Paul. He became something of a hermit, living on the top floor of his parents' place and writing nonstop on a draft of what would become This Side of Paradise. Very unlike him, he didn't party or drink, the latter of which is especially surprising since This Side of Paradise was about his Princeton years, which included his relationship with not only Ginevra and Zelda, but multiple other women. But perhaps this was because, at least according to him, he wasn't even in love with Zelda anymore. He wrote to a friend, "I wouldn't care if she died, but I couldn't stand to have anybody else marry her." Scott finished This Side of Paradise in September 1919, and the manuscript was accepted by the publishing company Charles Scribner's Sons. Despite what he told his friend, Scott was desperate to impress Zelda and asked Scribner's Sons to speed up its release to curry her favor. He moved back to New York and wrote to the publishers, "I have so many things depending on this book's success, including, of course, a girl." To make a long story short, because there's so much to tell, once the fickle Zelda heard about the success of Scott, she took him back, agreeing to marry him once the novel was published. This happened on March 26th of 1920. Zelda arrived in New York on the 30th, and the two were married 4 days later at St. Patrick's Cathedral. But Scott was just as fickle as his new wife. He claimed later that at their wedding, the two did not love each other, their first few years of marriage were disappointing, and according to biographer Andrew Turnbull, this was all because Scott's success had not happened before Zelda broke off the engagement. It also doesn't help that Scott was still hung up on Ginevra, and the fact that Scott had spent the last year plus rehashing their relationship when he wrote This Side of Paradise. Throughout his marriage to Zelda, Scott would routinely cry over Ginevra. Not exactly a stable foundation on which to build a marriage. Zelda and Scott quickly became New York celebrities, partly because of Scott's new novel, but mostly because they were a glamorous pair of troublemakers. Just 20 and 24, respectively, they partied like it was 1899, and routinely got kicked out of famous hotels like the Biltmore and the Commodore for being too destructive. They got drunk daily, and in general wreaked havoc, calling taxis, then riding on the hood, breaking into a morgue while drunk, and jumping into the fountain at the plaza fully clothed. Parties were a near daily occurrence, and the couple never stopped fighting in private. They were favorite subjects in the gossip newspapers, described as demonstrating youth of excess. Eventually, tired of getting kicked out of the hotel they were living in, the couple rented a cottage in Westport, Connecticut, so that Scott could work on his second novel. This left Zelda with very little to do, or rather, very little she was willing to do. Many young wives of the day might have been excited to make their house a home and, in general, execute wifely duties. But Zelda grew up wealthy, with servants. She had no idea how to be a wife that took care of her husband, or even a woman who took care of herself. In the first few months at the cottage, Scott noticed that he'd wear an item of clothing, and then he'd never see it again. Perhaps he thought Zelda was taking her time learning to wash them, but it was worse. One day, Scott opened a closet to find a tall pile of every item of clothing he'd worn while in Connecticut piled up to the ceiling. Zelda didn't know how to wash them, so she just didn't. After this, Scott hired two maids and a laundry lady. This wasn't quite the level of service Zelda was used to, but it did keep her from learning any basic skills. Once, when interviewed by Harper and Brothers, Zelda was asked what her favorite recipe was. She replied, "See if there's any bacon, and if there is, ask the cook which pan to fry it in. Then ask if there are any eggs, and if so, try and persuade the cook to poach two of them. Serve preferably on china plates, though gold or wood will do if handy." But Zelda would soon have no choice but to learn new skills because at 21, Zelda was pregnant. For real this time. While she grew a human, Scott worked on The Beautiful and the Damned. Zelda dreamed of their baby being born in the South, Scott dreamed of raising their child in the North. Scott ended up getting his way, as well as somehow naming his daughter Frances after himself by nicknaming her Scotty. And as Zelda was recovering from giving birth, Scott did one of my most hated things. He recorded Zelda's nonsensical chatter as she came out of anesthesia and immortalized what she said in The Great Gatsby. He also, with Zelda's permission this time, used a ton of her personal writing like diaries and letters in The Beautiful and the Damned, and yet again based the female main character on her, Mary suing his own way into the lead role for the second time. Not long after she gave birth to baby Scotty, Zelda found herself pregnant again. This time, though, she didn't want it to continue, so she did what she swore to Scott she'd never do. She got an abortion. We don't know how Zelda herself felt about this, but later, when Zelda's mental health started going downhill, her sister Rosalind suggested that the unsafe abortion was to blame. But the family just couldn't afford another baby. Scott's first novel had done well, but the Fitzgeralds tended to live above their means and spent money like water. So to help out, Zelda started doing some of her own writing for newspapers and magazines. Zelda presented herself as a silly, slightly clueless young girl in life, and she did the same on the page, which people loved. In one review of her husband's novel, she noted that she hoped people would buy the book because, quote, "there is the cutest cloth of gold dress for only $300 in a store on 42nd Street." Some might have suggested that if Zelda wanted her own writing career, she should take on a more professional, polished tone in her writing. But people knew Zelda as a shallow party girl and seemed to like the juxtaposition of Zelda's put-on insipid personality and her well-written observations. It was quite ingenious, actually. Zelda's silliness made people feel at ease, and then she snuck in her smarts when they weren't paying attention. After her irreverent first review, Zelda started getting more offers from magazines to write stories and articles. Some of her work appeared in Scribner's Magazine, College Humor, and Metropolitan Magazine. And for a brief moment, with Scott's play The Vegetable flopping in 1923, Zelda was the star of the relationship. In 1924, New York City fell victim to a tiny woman with short hair. This person, known as the Bobbed-Haired Bandit, robbed 10 businesses over the course of 5 months. Desperate to catch the criminal, Commissioner Richard Enright started striking out in the dark, hoping to nab the bandit. This resulted in multiple innocent women being accused of being the Bobbed-Haired Bandit, including Helen Quigley, an actress, Mary Cody, a random Brooklyn mom, and Zelda. And to be honest, given Zelda and Scott's misdeeds just a few years before, Enright's accusation wasn't without merit. However, Zelda was in fact innocent, and the arrest caused the Fitzgerald family to pick up and move to Paris. Or at least that was Scott's reasoning. Another reason may have been that, due to the failure of his play and the excitement over his books dying down, the family was once again broke, and Scott wondered if France might be cheaper. The Fitzgeralds ended up moving to Antibes on the French Riviera, and it was here that Zelda's first signs of mental illness manifested while Scott devoted his time to his next book, The Great Gatsby. Determined to make this book a success, Scott laid down the law to his wife and daughter. He would work on the novel every day, and woe betide anyone who interrupted him. To avoid bothering him, Zelda would often go to a nearby beach, where she'd take a dip in the Mediterranean and then practice her French with some naval pilots from a base nearby. One of the pilots was named Edouard Jozan, and Zelda decided that he was to be her next conquest. According to Scott, quote, "Since the day of our engagement, we have spent time hunting for some man Zelda considers strong enough to lean on. I am not." Zelda thought that Jozan, with his naval career and good looks, might be that man, and she latched onto him shortly after meeting. Jozan wasn't totally opposed to this, given that the two were seen out and about together quite often, but it seems Jozan and Zelda were on different pages, partly because Zelda barely spoke French and Jozan barely spoke English. Where Zelda saw the relationship as her next great love affair, Jozan seemed to see them as friends with benefits at most. In fact, Jozan even met Scott, the latter of whom said only that he liked Jozan and was glad Jozan was able to entertain Zelda while Scott worked on his book. In Zelda's mind, though, Jozan was the man she was meant to be with, and 5 weeks after meeting him, Zelda went home and told Scott she wanted a divorce because she was in love with someone else. Scott, of course, was taken aback and demanded that if Zelda was truly sure about leaving him, she and Jozan had to profess their love to each other in front of him. But this was where it all fell apart for Zelda. Knowing that having an affair would end his naval piloting career, Jozan refused to announce his devotion to Zelda and called off the relationship, whatever kind of relationship it truly was. And Kendall Taylor, author of The Gatsby Affair, a book exclusively about Zelda and Jozan's fling, points out that, quote, "To a degree, the affair was also a creation of Zelda and Scott's imagination." According to Taylor, Scott was well aware of Zelda's passion for Jozan and let it inspire the love triangle aspect of Gatsby. But Jozan scoffed at the clout chasing. Quote, "They both had a need of drama. They made the affair up, and perhaps they were the victims of their own unsettled and a little unhealthy imaginations." However serious or not serious the fling between Zelda and Jozan, Kendall Taylor suggests that Jozan's rejection triggered memories of Zelda's past sexual assault, and that's why she reacted so viscerally. Quote, "Trauma often generates psychosis, and in this instance, calamitous forces got released, triggering profound depression that culminated in Zelda's first suicide attempt." Taylor suggests that much like women today, Zelda had kept her past assault to herself, avoided dealing with the trauma even internally, and when Jozan rejected her, she was forced to deal with both events at once, and it was too much. Whatever the catalyst, Zelda's mental health declined over the next few years, but many people saw her not as mentally ill, but simply a charming, if dramatic and eccentric, young woman. But one person who wasn't fooled by Zelda was Ernest Hemingway. It was in Paris in 1925 that Hemingway and Zelda first met. Scott was a huge fan of Hemingway, but Hemingway was not a huge fan of Zelda. He told Scott in no uncertain terms that Zelda was insane, writing in a memoir that the moment he knew it was so was when Zelda claimed that jazz musician Al Jolson was greater than Jesus. But even outside of her hyperbolic claims, Zelda was simply not nice to Hemingway. She used homophobic slurs to refer to him, convinced that Hemingway's masculinity was a put-on to hide his gayness. Additionally, Hemingway felt that Zelda was jealous of Scott's writing career and would eventually ruin him. He wrote to Scott, "I thought Zelda was crazy the first time I met her, and you complicated it even more by being in love with her. And of course, you're an alcoholic." Zelda, of course, was threatened by Scott and Hemingway's friendship and expanded her homophobia to her own husband, accusing the two men of being lovers. She would berate Scott in public, using the same slurs she'd used toward Hemingway, and most likely anyone else she wasn't happy with at the time. Interestingly, while biographer Michael J. Broccoli believes that Zelda's homophobic accusations were a result of her burgeoning mental illness, many contemporaries of Scott also believe that he might have been gay. Perhaps to disprove these rumors, or just to stick it to Zelda, Scott decided to pay a Parisian sex worker. However, before the encounter even happened, Zelda found the condoms he planned to use, resulting in a huge fight. Then, around the same time, the couple attended a party where Scott chose to ignore Zelda and lavish attention on dancer Isadora Duncan. In response, Zelda threw herself down a marble staircase. Paris, clearly, was not the new start the Fitzgeralds had hoped for, and in late 1926, the unhappy family moved back to the US. But the Fitzgeralds couldn't simply abandon their woes in Paris. Jealousy, wrath, and general unhappiness followed the couple all the way to Hollywood. Scott was commissioned to write a short story for United Artists, and while in LA, met Hollywood star Lois Moran. To no one's shock, Zelda became unbearably jealous of the time Scott and Moran spent together, describing Moran as a breakfast food that many men identified with whatever they missed from life. To protest Scott's new friend, Zelda dumped some of her clothes in a bathtub and lit them on fire. Of course, none of this made the marriage better, nor did a move to Wilmington, Delaware in March of 1927. In Delaware, Zelda's behavior became more erratic, and Scott's drinking got even worse. Their unhappiness was, of course, multi-layered, but two things that made them fairly incompatible were, first, that Scott craved quiet while Zelda was easily bored, and second, just a mismatch of personalities. Add to that mental illness, possibly on both sides, and Scott's constant drinking, and they were doomed. Still, they remained together, and Scott tried his best to make Zelda happy, catering to even nonsensical whims. For example, when she was 28, Zelda became re-obsessed with ballet and decided that she was going to be a prima ballerina. Her friend Gerald Murphy pointed out that as a 28-year-old whose ballet training was long past, Zelda's chances of becoming any sort of dancer were unlikely. But Scott, eager to keep Zelda in a good mood, and perhaps out of his hair, paid for Zelda to start taking lessons with Catherine Littlefield, the director of the Philadelphia Opera Ballet. Even when the family went to Europe for the summer, Zelda insisted on continuing her training, studying under a Russian ballerina in Paris. Now, had ballet been a hobby for Zelda, all of this might have been harmless. But Zelda was determined to make it as a performer, and became unhealthily obsessed. In September 1929, the San Carlo Opera Ballet in Naples, Italy, invited Zelda to join their ballet school. And to prepare, Zelda would dance for up to 8 hours a day, which, according to Scott, destroyed her physical and mental health. One night, Scott returned home to find Zelda slumped on the floor, staring at a pile of sand. He asked her what she was doing. She didn't answer. Scott called a doctor, whom, upon examining Zelda, told Scott, "Your wife is mad." Zelda's health, every aspect of it, started to go downhill at this point. She had worked herself nearly to death in pursuit of an impossible dancing dream, and nothing seemed to undo the damage. In October of 1929, a month after the doctor's visit in Europe, Zelda was driving Scott and 9-year-old Scotty in the countryside of France when she suddenly tried to drive the car off of a cliff. After this, Scott was determined to get her help, but it wasn't until April of the following year that she finally received inpatient treatment at Paris, at the Malmaison Clinic. This was when she experienced her first mental breakdown, and according to Kendall Taylor, quote, "At her first psychological evaluation, her thinking was scattered, she was riddled with anxiety, could not eat or sleep, and was experiencing hallucinations. She had also just attempted suicide with an overdose of sleeping pills." With a tentative diagnosis of schizophrenia, Zelda was then transferred to the Valmont Clinic in Switzerland. The clinic was generally for the treatment of gastrointestinal disorders, but the doctors thought perhaps Zelda's symptoms stemmed from a physical complaint. However, after 2 weeks of observation, she didn't seem to be suffering from any physical or neurological disease. Dr. Oscar Farrell was brought in. Farrell was the son of August Farrell, director of the psychiatric hospital of the University of Zurich, and Oscar had taken up the family business, heading the Prangins Clinic, also in Switzerland. After examining Zelda, Farrell pronounced that a simple rest cure would not be enough for Zelda. He wasn't sure what her diagnosis was, but asked that Zelda accompany him to the Prangins Clinic for treatment. On June 5th, 1930, Zelda, Scott, and Zelda's brother-in-law, Newman Smith, traveled to the clinic. The two men were certain that this was a new start for Zelda, but Zelda considered the trip to be the end of her life. The Prangins Clinic, while it was considered a place for the more upper crust of society, they charged today's equivalent of $174,000 a year, was still a hospital of its time, and when Zelda panicked at her situation once her husband and brother-in-law left, no doctor attempted to reason with her. As her distress rose, she was forcibly restrained and knocked out with morphine. She wrote to Scott, "If you knew what this is like, you would not dare in the eyes of God leave a person in it. Please help me. If there is nobody in this barred brothel who will look at me, I demand that I be allowed to go immediately to a hospital in France where there is enough human kindness to prevent the present slow butchery." All things considered, and especially compared to the many other psychiatric facilities of the day, the Prankins Clinic was a nice place. The small fortune patients paid got them a 100-acre park containing a golf course, a lake, tennis courts, and a riding stable. But Zelda's struggles there weren't just with her mental illness. Very few of the medical personnel spoke English, and even those who did couldn't understand Zelda's southern accent, leaving Zelda entirely alone. She didn't feel safe or even able to describe to the doctors and nurses what was going on in her mind, and began to plot her escape. She attempted to leave several times during her first month there. A few of the attempts landed her in a straitjacket in solitary confinement, something we know today only contributes to mental health problems. Zelda wrote to Scott, "For a month and 2 weeks, I have been 3 times outside of my room, and for 5 months, I have lived with my sole desire, that of death." Over her years and months in psychiatric care starting in 1930, Zelda would write to Scott, begging him to reconsider, allow her to go home to Montgomery, basically do anything but make her stay at the clinic. But Zelda was a woman in the 1930s, and a diagnosed crazy one at that. No one was going to listen to her, even though one of the most popular treatments at the clinic for disorderly patients was to strangle them with a wet towel around their neck until they lost consciousness. The men in Zelda's life were going to listen to the men of the clinic, and Dr. Farrell had old-fashioned ideas of what women should and should not be doing. He was convinced that Zelda's psychiatric issues were due to the life of overstimulating excess she'd been living. He pronounced Zelda's focus on dance a result of an obsessive disorder. Farrell's goal, not only for Zelda, but for all female patients, was to use therapies and sedatives to force them into the box society had prepared for them. After nearly 6 months at the clinic, Dr. Farrell was still uncertain what Zelda's diagnosis was. She seemed depressed, but also obsessive, but also restless. He wrote, "The more I saw Zelda, the more I thought she is neither suffering from pure neuroses nor a real psychosis. I considered her a constitutional, emotionally unbalanced psychopath." He called on the expertise of Dr. Eugene Bleuler, a Swiss psychiatrist. Bleuler examined Zelda for 3 hours and emerged with a diagnosis that he himself had named a decade before, schizophrenia, what had been hinted at months before. Biographers of Zelda have shed doubt on this diagnosis, as at the time it was something of a catch-all term. But in the moment, it was accepted and definitive, and doomed Zelda to spend the rest of her life in asylums. Modern-day psychiatrists believe that Zelda may have actually been bipolar, but whatever her diagnosis at the time, Zelda was not feeling any relief from her treatment. She wrote to Scott, "I have quite lost my mind and roam all over the place in half a daze that is exceedingly unpleasant to bear. You promised me long ago, last spring, that you would help me get out of this confinement. Please let me go home." It wasn't until the end of 1931 that Zelda got her wish. She was finally discharged to Scott. At first, things seemed to be going well. One thing that had kept Zelda afloat at Prangins was writing, and a piece she'd written, while, as she put it, incarcerated, titled Miss Ella, was published in Scribner's Magazine in December of 1931. Scott, wanting her to be as safe as possible, hired nurses and carers to be with Zelda when he couldn't. But the presence of professionals couldn't keep Zelda's mind under control, and while most of the time she was simply eccentric, sometimes she'd become violent or actively suicidal. She once tried to throw herself in front of a train. And on February 12, 1932, Zelda had a relapse. And to Scott's surprise, despite the terrible time she'd had at Prangins, Zelda actually requested to be hospitalized. Scott tried to talk her out of it, but was convinced to take her to Phipps Clinic at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. It also so happened that a colleague of Dr. Farrell, Adolf Meyer, was the director of Phipps. But Phipps had something that Zelda's previous hospitals didn't have, Dr. Mildred Squires. And Dr. Squires really made a huge difference. Rather than treating patients with violent methods, Squires chose talking over drugs. And especially important to Zelda, Squires allowed her to have 2 hours of writing each day. The other doctors were not happy, but neither woman cared, and Zelda began work on what would become Save Me the Waltz. She finished it by her 8th week at Phipps and dedicated it to Dr. Squires. At one point, Squires asked Scott why he thought Zelda was in the state she was in. He replied, "Perhaps 50% of our friends and relatives would tell you in all honest conviction that my drinking drove Zelda insane. The other half would assure you that her insanity drove me to drink. Neither judgment would mean anything. The solipsism is flooring." Scott further made Save Me the Waltz about him by essentially accusing Zelda of plagiarizing his work in progress, Tender is the Night, and his previously published This Side of Paradise. He wrote her nasty letter after nasty letter about this, to which Zelda sent back apologies that Scott refused to accept. And yet, the family needed money, so in the midst of making his wife feel as terrible as possible, he pitched the book to his editor. The editor accepted it, but begrudgingly. Scott owed Scribner's today's equivalent of $19,000, so it was arranged that half of Zelda's royalties would be put toward that debt. On top of dealing with her asshole husband, Zelda also had Dr. Squires taken away from her. The closeness of the women's relationship annoyed the male doctors, and coincidentally, Dr. Squires was transferred to another hospital just a few months later. While Zelda had a good relationship with Squire's replacement, soon after Squire's departure, Zelda was ready to leave Phipps, ready to go back to Scott and Scotty. But she was far from stabilized. After having lunch with Scott and Zelda, literary critic H.L. Mencken wrote that Zelda was clearly only half sane, and commented that it was a shame Scott wasted all his time writing short stories for magazines to pay for Zelda's medical care when he should be writing novels. Speaking of novels, Save Me the Waltz was published, and it got terrible reviews. The New York Times wrote, "It is not only her publishers that have seen fit to curb an almost ludicrous lushness of writing, but they have not given the book the elementary services of a literate proofreader." Of course, none of this was good for Zelda's already fragile mental health, and she soon spiraled to the point of being hospitalized again. This time she went to Craig House in Beacon, New York, arriving on March 9, 1934. The hospital, rather than being separated into wards, actually had each patient living in their own cottage with a private nurse, and Zelda enjoyed doing art in occupational therapy. In fact, after seeing some of her work, Scott arranged a month-long exhibit in the lobby of the famous Algonquin Hotel. But what Scott wasn't willing to let Zelda do was write. He had promised her that after his novel Tender is the Night was published, she could keep working on a new novel, but he was evasive every time she followed up. Exasperated that she wasn't allowed to fully enjoy the luxury of Craig House, Zelda wrote to Scott that he should just save his money and send her to a state hospital. She wrote, "You must realize that to one as ill as I am, one place is not very different from another, and that I would appreciate you making whatever adjustments render your life less difficult. I cannot see why I should sit in luxury when you are having such a struggle. Since there seems to be no way in which I can hasten my recovery, maybe it would be wise to try a cheaper place." Scott listened to her, and found Enoch and Shepherd Pratt Hospital back in Maryland. This was still a private hospital, but much less expensive than Craig House, and unfortunately, the drop in price also meant a drop in the quality of treatment. Zelda wrote to Scott, "Life is very difficult. There are so many problems. The problem of how to stay here, the problem of how to get out." She tried again to write, but her husband told her that everything she did had to have his approval. From Kendall Taylor's blog, he dismissed her work as amateurish, saying that she had nothing original to offer and would never have gotten published in the first place but for his reputation. Everything was related to his celebrity. "Why do you think you were in the Russian ballet? Why do you think Johns Hopkins accepted you? They did it for commercial reasons. That was part of their advertising." And to be frank, I agree with Scott, and that makes me dislike him all the more. Scott was the reason Zelda got to pursue ballet professionally long after most dancers do. He was the reason she was published. He was the reason she had her art show at the Algonquin. But never was she actually talented enough to see success from any of these fields. And in the case of her writing and her art, she received terrible reviews which further sank her into depression. Perhaps if Zelda was simply allowed to do things for fun, without her famous husband trying to keep being famous, her mental health would have been more stable. Even Zelda herself knew that she wasn't ready for any of the opportunities she'd been given, saying once in group therapy that she was, quote, "a third-rate writer and a third-rate ballet dancer." Despite round-the-clock treatment, Zelda continued to decline. Scott reported that every time he visited her, she seemed to be more unstable. So in April of 1936, she was moved to Highland Hospital in Asheville, North Carolina, where things continued to go downhill. Scott wrote, "Zelda now claims to be in direct contact with Christ, William the Conqueror, Mary Stuart, Apollo, and all the stock paraphernalia of insane asylum jokes." Her behavior was unnerving, too. Once when Scott visited Asheville and took her to lunch, Zelda threw herself out of the car on the way back. While playing tennis at the hospital, Zelda got upset that she lost and hit her opponent on the head with her racket. Perhaps it was this decline in behavior that urged her doctors to start her on electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, and insulin shock treatments. Despite the questionable nature of insulin shock treatments, whatever Highland Hospital did seemed to work, at least a little bit. Zelda didn't appreciate the strict, bland diet prescribed by the head doctor, but gradually she started to have interest in things she used to love, like art. She wrote, "I am coming to life. A bright spot amongst years and years of suffering." And after 4 years at Highland, Zelda felt that she was ready to return to the real world. But instead of living with Scott, she decided she wanted to live with her mother. Her father had died a few years before. So on April 5th, 1940, nearly 4 years to the day of her arrival at the hospital, Zelda got on a bus headed for Montgomery, Alabama. Once she arrived, she wrote to Scott, "It's wonderful to be free from those obligations of hospital routine. It would seem impossible that a person could have been so exhausted as I was and still survive." She was feeling more charitable toward her husband, and she and Scott planned a visit in December of 1940. Things really seemed to be looking up for Zelda. And then Scott died the month of their scheduled meeting. F. Scott Fitzgerald was only 44 when he died of a heart attack. His reunification with Zelda never came to be, and due to her mental health declining again, she wasn't able to attend his funeral in Maryland. She also missed her daughter Scotty's wedding for the same reason. And in August of 1943, she checked back in to Highland Hospital. Zelda would spend the rest of her short life in and out of hospitals. A decade of the ECT and insulin therapy had reportedly caused memory loss and an apathetic personality. And unlike her last stint at Highland, Zelda didn't seem to be improving. Her friend Edna Garlington Spratt saw her a few months before she died and wrote, "She was anything but pretty when I saw her. She acted normal, but she looked dreadful. She had lost all pride in herself." Allegedly, in early March 1948, Zelda was told she was cured, but she decided to stay on for further treatment. This would be a fatal decision, as just a few days later, on March 10th, a fire broke out in the hospital kitchen. Zelda and a few patients were sedated and locked in a room on the fifth floor, which is where they would perish when the fire spread to every floor. She had to be identified through dental records. Zelda was just 48 years old and never got to meet her first grandchild, Eleanor, who was 2 months old when Zelda died. Zelda was buried next to Scott and the rest of the Fitzgerald family in Rockville, Maryland. The shared headstone bears the final sentence of The Great Gatsby: "So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly." And unlike many of the other people I cover on this podcast, the world has not forgotten Zelda. Perhaps this is due to being married to a famous author, but Zelda did plenty on her own, as questionable as I find those things. In 1992, she and Scotty were posthumously inducted into the Alabama Women's Hall of Fame. And as of this writing, a hotel inspired by Zelda, called Zelda Dearest, occupies Asheville, decorated in the 1920s style of Zelda's youth. The website reads, "See Southern hospitality through the eyes of intoxicating delight, Zelda Fitzgerald." Thanks for checking out We're All Mad Here. I am really, really hoping to get out more regular episodes and bring you guys more stories every other week. Please check out the show's Instagram, All Mad Pod, for episode-related pictures. And I'll see you guys in 2 weeks.